where there are large bodies of fresh water, such as unfrozen lakes or rivers, that would be possible to pump from the unfrozen lake. At Galena, we were able to drill 200 feet through the permafrost to a freshwater lake. However, in the North Slope, this will not be possible because we're talking about permafrost that's from 800 to 1,500 feet deep. One of the problems in water supply is that the pathogenic organisms, much to your surprise, live a long time in the extreme cold, and we have to be sure to treat our water and to treat our waste to avoid damaging ourselves now or future generations. In short, we have a great deal of research to do in the question of water supply in order to provide the liberal policy, supply policy, that is going to be required for morale purposes in a northern community. Waste disposal, we think that because of the extremely short summer season in the Arctic, biological oxygen demand is going to be the critical problem. We don't think we're going to be able to use the aerated lagoon shown here, which has been so successful to us in the sub-Arctic. Here, the lagoon is about 1 acre in area, and it will be filled to a depth of about 10 feet with the waste. And we have a pipe, an aluminum pipe, that goes around the lagoon into which is pumped air under pressure. This air is in turn passes into perforated hoses, which are spread along the base of the lagoon. The percolating action of the oxygen keeps the aerobic decomposition of the organic matter going throughout the winter. I learned tonight that Inuvik has such a lagoon, and I will be interested in following it up. There are a few packaged sewage disposal units operating in heated buildings in the Arctic. But today we have not solved the waste disposal problem as easily as we have in the sub-Arctic. To get rid of our waste, we have used utilidors, which are familiar to you here in Fairbanks. This is a walk-through type utilidor, which carries the steam, the water, the waste lines, and the simpler version, the smaller version, which would be covered. And then in the pictures of Inuvik, all the above ground type of utility. One of the big problems, another big problem, is the question of water vapor in the air. The relative humidity in the Arctic, if uncorrected, would be about 2 to 3% in a heated building. This causes respiratory discomfort, shrinkage and destruction of materials, particularly wood, and the nuisance of static electricity. We find that we can, if you try to add water vapor, you get frosting around windows and in other cold spots. We find that in the Anchorage area, we can humidify up to the 25 to 60% relative humidity comfort level by using thermopane windows. In the Arctic, we estimate that it will require the additional expense of triple thermopane in order to reach the 25% minimum comfort level. Because of the difference in humidity between the interior and the exterior of buildings, the water molecules migrate outward under great pressure. Now, as they pass through the wall and the insulation, they reach the dew point plane, as depicted by that blue line, where the dew point temperature occurs and where these water molecules turn to ice crystals. As the ice crystals build up until we have eventually a solid wall of ice. This causes a reduction in the insulating properties of the walls and higher heat losses. I'm told that after periods, extended periods of minus 40 weather here in the Fairbanks area, the oil burner just doesn't shut off. This is the type of thing that happens. Then when the thaw comes, the water melts, the interior finish is damaged, and the walls tend to be destroyed by the water. We have found that by the addition of a vapor barrier, a membrane just inside the wall board, it is possible to control the migration of these water molecules. There are very excellent membrane materials available now. The problem is to get them installed without gaps and cracks and holes, such as the extra electrical outlets, for example. So the control of water vapor, the vapor barriers, is an installation problem. Now closely related to this is the heating problem. We've got to have ventilation to take out odors, exhaust gases, and excessive moisture. We must, however, protect the intakes from snow and wind and rain, and the exhaust has to be protected from frost, which would tend to block it. Some buildings are now being equipped with a ventilating system which provides a positive pressure, interior pressure, low pressure of 2 or 3 pounds per square inch, which prevent the infiltration of cold air. One of the great logistic problems in our remote sites has been the fuel supply. And this is one of the things that has given rise to the emergence of the state flower that was described this afternoon. The 55-gallon oil drum. Consequently, we have used the waste heat from the generators to heat many of our buildings. And despite the possibility of a relatively cheap source of energy in the natural gas that we think will be available, we will probably continue to use waste heat recovery measures for heating the buildings. These heating plants are going to be quite complicated, however. This is just one example. We're going to have to think about things like zone temperature control. For example, on the southern exposure of a building, you're going to get enormous radiant energy from the sun through the doors and windows, while you're freezing to death on the north side. This calls, again, for zone temperature control. We're going to have to provide an auxiliary source of power and heat in case the main heating system fails. Otherwise, we would be destroyed. In general, the heating system is going to have to be a very sophisticated one, and we've got to have good people to maintain it, to keep it from breaking down, and to avoid fire. I think the one area in which we know the least is in the design of an effective and durable roof. Above this structure, the roof is warmer than out on the eaves. Consequently, as the snow melts, the water trickles down the roof until it reaches the colder eave where it freezes, forming the glaciation you see, which can be dangerous, and also forming little pools of water behind the ice, which find their way back through the roofing material and into the structure itself. The obvious solution to this was to build a flat roof. So we went through an era in which everything had a flat roof. But we found that the roofing materials were not able to withstand pools of water for extended periods, and we had to replace the flat roof with a gently sloping roof. Now here is a typical barracks building at Fort Wayne. We felt that we could control this building by making a cold attic in In other words, placing the insulation inside above the rooms themselves and having the attic at a freezing temperature so that the thaw would not occur. So we modified the buildings, and you can't see it, but there's just a few icicles hanging from the eaves. This solution works, the cold air. Now, for large buildings, we have a problem of having so much snow and such a long way for the melted ice, melted snow to go, that we have gone to the gently sloping roof sections in short sections with internal drains. You see those two vertical lines indicating the internal drains that extend along the building. The same here. You notice the turned up eaves with drains at the saw. The problem of the roofing material, we have recently examined the built-up roof, which should last for 15 to 20 years, and which has been known to fail in the shorter periods of year. And we're now installing at Fort Wainwright the first elastomeric roof that we have installed. It is a liquid neoprene that is sprayed on the conventional roof surface. This holds great promise for us. This is Cape Lisburn, and with such a remote site and such a short summer season, you would think that we should turn to prefabricated buildings and modular construction. This is true, but it is not to be confused with the current search for prefabs and modular units to meet the low-cost housing demand in urban redevelopment and in school construction. Unless provisions are made in these prefabricated buildings for these various unique features that have been described to you, they will not be adaptable to the market, manufacturers' claims notwithstanding. Now, for this area, we initially built timber buildings connected by walkways. But as they became obsolete, we began to think about new buildings, and we realized that one of our greatest costs was in the foundation and in the utilities, and that we would be better off placing it in one composite structure rather than spreading it out over the building. Here are two structures. First, this is at Ten City, which is built a single composite building built with concrete. And this is at Cape Lisburn, which is steel frame, and it is covered with a sandwich of aluminum and foam. Now, this is a new material that we have never used before, but the sandwich panels saved $189,000 over the next cheapest alternative. To give you some idea of the effort in Cape Lisburn to create the environment, first, it's an elevated foundation built on the excavation and filled metal. Here shown in red is a plinth, a space that carries all the utility lines, the ventilating ducts, and which protects the first floor from the infiltrating cold air. On the first floor, shown here, the building is designed around a mall, a central mall, with shops and offices and mess hall on one side, and then a corridor around the outside with the sleeping rooms facing the exterior wall. On the second floor, there is a similar mall and a similar arrangement otherwise, but with a well in the mall connecting the lower level and the upper level to give a feeling of space if you lack in the building. To avoid the hazard of fire, the services are located in an external building, the generator, the heating plant, the motor maintenance facilities, with a connecting utility. We've tried to create the environment that is pleasant and satisfying to the occupants. This is Tin City today. Cape Lisburn is not yet complete. The roof at Cape Lisburn, you will note it's a series of gently sloping panels to an internal drain with an electric heater inside the drain to be sure that it stays open. This building at Cape Lisburn was designed by Mr. Crittenden's firm. We are very proud of it. I think it's going to be an outstanding contribution to our knowledge. Now compare these two facilities with Whittier. Whittier is a remote seaport 70 miles from Anchorage. In the early, it was to be the principal supply port for the military in Alaska. And in the early 50s, we built this building to supply, to house the military personnel. This was the Buckner Building. It was 7 stories high, and it contained every conceivable facility: barracks, mess hall, rifle range, barbershop, beauty shop, you name it. And because to meet the urgent need for families, why, this high-rise, 14-story, highest building was constructed. It contained 177 1, 2, and 3 bedroom units. In 1960, when Anchorage became an all-weather, developed as an all-weather port, Whittier began to phase out, and by 1960, it was badly damaged in 1964 by the earthquake, and only the first four floors of the Hodge Building are used today. Now, how did we do in designing this Arctic community circa 1954? Well, some people say that when it was fully occupied and fully staffed, that it was a very interesting place to be, that there was something for every talent and interest. Others say that it was a beehive, an overstimulated social life and no way out. That the long elevator shafts in the Hodge Building created a whale that did not let up day or night, winter or summer. And this soon got on people's nerves. In retrospect, from the engineering point of view, I think we built very well. I think we would do it differently today, but the big point is that where you plan to introduce dependence, your problems increase by some exponential factor. In conclusion, the military construction in Alaska has certainly been a laboratory for developing the techniques. We realize the need in the military construction for creating an environment. And as the architect engineers for the military, we have learned that it's going to take careful design, attention to detail, the imaginative use of new materials, and above all, quality construction. The success in creating this new environment is going to be dependent upon understanding the needs fully and a willingness to go beyond the usual austerity of institutional construction. Thank you.
Thank you, Colonel Hardin. We're now at the closing stage of our panel, in which we're going to introduce short, brief, conceptual ideas and some pictures of conceptual plans, really with the idea not that these are the acme, this is what we should go in for and build, but rather as just ideas, imaginative concepts with the idea of thought generation. I'm going to call first on Mrs. McCabe, who is a senior planner with the Alaska State Housing Authority, for a few comments on planning of this nature.
You think so?
Is this working?
Well, I'd like to talk at a very different, go from Colonel Hardin has been talking about the level of individual buildings. I'd like to talk about the distribution of cities within a region. And particularly, I'd like to mention an aspect of regional planning that I think has relevance to the distribution of communities in Native Alaska, and a very practical implication about public investment in communities in Native Alaska, in Western Alaska. Well, it has been found that generally in regions where there is little interaction between people, in regions where there's a subsistence economy, and often in underdeveloped economies, their cities assume what is called a primate distribution within a region. This is really where there are a number of very similar cities, small cities of similar sizes, and a few. Is this an improvement? Well, a primate distribution is a distribution of cities in a region where there are a number of cities of very equal size, often very small cities, and several larger ones. And this often happens, it's been found, in regions where there is little interaction, where there, well, often in a subsistence economy. And I think that this is very typical of Western Alaska. There are approximately 178 villages, and the median size is 155 people. 90% of the villages are under a population of 500. And then there are five cities that have now become the distribution hubs: Barrow, Nome, Kotzebue, Bethel, and Dillingham. And then in contrast to this primate pattern, regional planners have identified what is called a rank size distribution of cities that seems to occur in areas where there's a great deal of interaction, and communities in older countries, often of a relatively self-contained economy, where there is entropy is the word they use, where many diverse factors work on affect communities. And this pattern is something of a hierarchy of different sizes of community, and it sounds a bit like science fiction, but this is the way it works, that often if you divide cities by their size, if you rank them by their size, and take the rank of a city and divide it into the largest, it gives the population of that city. This is a theory that has been tested a good deal because it's fairly fascinating, and it has been found to describe reality in a number of cases. But the point of a region's place on this continuum between a primate distribution and a rank size distribution has to do with the amount of interaction often between peoples in the area, the amount of trade and commerce. And I think what this has to say about Native Alaska is that right now it appears that there are factors that are increasing the amount of interaction and communication between people in Native Alaska. Education is improving, and one very simple thing is the fact that the snowmobile has widened the range of travel of the Native people. There is considerably more contact with the modern economy. This, I think this has to say that Native Alaska will change gradually from a primate distribution to a wider range of city sizes. And the importance of this, I think, at this point in time is that investment in Native Alaska is increasing, has been accelerating very recently, partly with the attention that has been paid to, well, with the Native land claims and with the housing, Native housing hearings. There are a number of new public investment programs, as you all know, the remote housing program, the rural electrification program, and improved health services. And it seemed if this rate of investment probably can only accelerate with the state oil leases, and with if the Native land claim issue is solved, there will be considerable private or Native investment in communities. It appears, I'm not really posing any answers, but I think that this is a good subject for study, the future distribution of communities, because in Native Alaska, it appears quite important to know about the relative sizes, which communities will be the sub-regional centers and the regional centers to make wise investments and to avoid white elephants in the future. I think that's about all.
Can you hear me in this one? This one work all right? Ladies and gentlemen, in reviewing the slides presented by Mr. Crittenden, you've received a cross-section of settlement planning and new concepts in this field, and results of improper planning and haphazard construction and development. We in Canada have attempted to anticipate a number of these problem areas and take steps to rectify these at the earliest opportunity. Perhaps to explain a little further, I might give a brief outline of the history of our development planning. Although the Eskimos have lived in the Canadian North for many years, our association has really been restricted to the latter part of the century. It is doubtful whether any villages as we know them existed prior to the early 1950s. They live mostly in camp areas, inhabited by family groups closely bonded together. Their resources were derived from land and the sea. With the establishment of police posts, missions, and schools, it was only natural for them to drift into these communities and in anticipation of housing and some other construction. In most cases, land for development was at a premium, and it soon became apparent that settlement planning was required immediately. In 1964, the federal government initiated a program of construction of 1,600 homes for Eskimo families across the Arctic North in approximately 40 settlements. This program was to be constructed over a four-year period. You can readily understand the impact of 1,600 new homes might have on a very small community with a Hudson Bay Company or a mission. The question arose on how best to tackle the problem of locating these housing units and other associated services. You've seen the slides of Pelly Bay. First, the way it was, with a few shacks made from packing cases, and the way it is now with a number, probably 50, of the new Eskimo-type house, with all supplied with services, both fuel and electricity. Although it is recognized that this type of conventional community presents no new concept in planning, we were faced with a major problem to house all families without disturbing to a great extent their method of living. Our policy was at that time, and is today, is to consult with our northern peoples, and where possible, and provided the suggestions are economically sound, accede to their wishes. This move to community living is a rapid change from existing camp life, and there is a need to slow down the process to enable an early assimilation of the peoples into the 20th century. No doubt other concepts of settlement planning might be just as viable as long as the desired results are achieved. I would like to mention that most of the communities of which we are speaking have a population of between 200 and 600 people, and there are approximately 40 such settlements in the Arctic region alone. Other settlements of larger size, of which there are very few above the tree line, are expanding much more rapidly due to migration of Eskimos into the communities. Frobisher Bay is one of these. It has a population of approximately 2,000, of which two-thirds are Eskimo. The slide presented earlier on Frobisher Bay depicted the proposal for a new development. This program, which is now under construction, included the erection of an eight-story apartment building, three-story hotel, two-story office building, single-story shopping areas, recreation facilities, town housing, and all arranged with interconnected walkways and a covered mall. This community is spread over a distance of approximately 5 miles at the present time into three separate areas. We are attempting to bring it together. In the replanning phase, we are trying to create a focal point to tie these areas closer and to emphasize rather than to suppress the terrain. We use this project as a means to entice private capital to the north. The work is being carried out by the contractor at his cost, with the Crown renting the necessary facilities. We need more of this type of development, and we need the people as well. Perhaps I should say a very few words about one other program, and that is the creation of the resource town of Faro in the central Yukon, approximately 130 miles from Whitehorse. It has a subarctic climate, permafrost, with an active layer of between 4 and 10 feet, depending upon location. And it will house initially 1,200 people, but expand to approximately 3,600 after the mine is in operation. In considering the planning of this town, undertaken by architects and planners, retained by both the mining company and the Yukon Territorial Government, it was decided at an early date that planning should begin with a central complex of high density, with a grouped staged residential cluster surrounding the core, At the same time, allocating commercial land on the perimeter to assure balanced growth. In terms of urban design, it appears that resource towns utilize similar principles. High density, with the housing near the center, and the town center having recreation facilities with the undesirable services and industry on the fringe, and curvilinear and site-orientated road systems. Underlining these basic factors was the need for the designer and planner to provide for expansion, the orientation of the buildings for maximum sun exposure, and to avoid permafrost areas, and to ensure a compact community and the privacy of individuals. In considering these three types of community planning, we were vitally concerned on the question of priorities. I do not think there's any doubt that a more advanced concept of planning might be acceptable in either case. The question is, when? Should we plan and construct edifices which are very high cost without first attempting to find an economic base to support this program? Or should we maintain the status quo and be prepared to advance when the people are ready and the resource development has taken place and can support such a venture? I'm sure that there are many answers, and probably a great many are acceptable. In conclusion, I would like to state that we have no radical new concepts in community planning to offer at this time, but would really ask, when is a change really necessary? Are we concerned more about new concepts rather than consolidating, expanding, and improving the urban planning and design, and applying these new criteria to northern communities with their hostile environment to ensure a compact community? Do we take the first step now? If changes are necessary, we must ensure consideration is given not only to the physical development, but also to the social, environmental problems, as well as the needs and wishes of the northern people who are our greatest resource. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Armstrong. Now we have one more person to hear from. Last but not least by a lot, Mr. David Hitchcock, who is, by your announcement here, connected with the Federal Field Committee and the Director of the Natural Resources. He has a tremendous interest in this subject, and he has a message to give you. Now, following his talk, we'll open up the panel audience for questions. If you have, when we get through with this question business, if you have a desire to stay, we have a few conceptual, far-out, schematic layouts that we can throw at you on the screen, or we can call the session to a close. We will let the decision be in your hands. Dave, would you?
Thank you, Aaron. I only have very few remarks to make, and I'll make them short. The hour grows late. But I would like to make some direct comments about a possible community in the present North Slope oil area. And I'd like to take a look at something like this. And between the Canning and the Colville Rivers, between the foothills of the Brooks Range and the Beaufort Sea, some 7 to 10 million acres, depending on how you figure it, there is the sedimentary basin that is open to oil exploration and ultimate oil production. There are other areas outside of those lines of dimensions at the moment, but that's what's available now. In my opinion, there will be communities come. And I think everything in human experience around the world with this industry and with others says it will. They'll come, I think, in connection with three or four things. First, if there's a port developed in connection with the Manhattan Project or other effects to the sea, there will be a community to take care of port situations. If a railroad terminus or a road ends somewhere, there's going to become a town there. Now, another factor that will enter into this, besides those three things, is the application of our public land laws, whether state or federal. Once the land freeze in Alaska is lifted, the surface estate can be filed on in many, many ways by the people. And I think you will see, if you don't have planning, I think you will see all the arrangements and irrational little business arrangements move in. Now, whether or not they think they'll get business directly or not, I think is immaterial, because they'll put on the pressure to get the business. Anyway, they'll come. They always have, and I think they will. The other thing, I think, is the possible application of native land claims, which could open up the settlement of that could also be a device to establish communities there. But in any event, I think, I'll make the assumption, if you will, that a community will come. And I think here is government's concern and the public's concern. We need communities in the right places to avoid the social costs of that we've experienced in many, many parts of the country. For example, right here in Fairbanks, which was originally a mining community located in the floodplain of the Chena River. Well, right now, the oil companies, for example, have located many of their major properties in the floodplain of Sagavanirktok. Now, the Sagavanirktok in recent years has flooded 10 miles on each side of that river. And those existing communities, one of these days, the frequency range of things, are going to get their feet wet. Now, I think that's a cost. If industry wants to absorb it and take it directly, that's their business. But if a community does come and it's in the wrong place, then it becomes a governmental cost, and I don't think the public, when it has the opportunity to plan in advance, should absorb such costs. Now, in the last few weeks ago, I spent a couple of weeks prowling around looking at a number of environmental factors in the Arctic, but also looking for a possible sites that would correlate a number of environmental factors for a place to have such a town. And I don't have any brief for any one place or another, but I will mention some of the things I looked at. I think there is along the coast, of course, a fog belt. If you're going to have in a long range situation, aircraft operations that are VFR for as much the time as possible, you've got to go at least 30 miles inland to be practical, maybe around the Franklin Bluffs at least, or further in. There is in the wintertime along the coast, the Arctic coast, a saltwater intrusion in the ground plane, in the ground aquifers, and even where you can find fresh water. In the winter, this dries up and there's an intrusion of salt water into those water supplies. There are some places where the permafrost is not a big factor against getting a good water supply. There are in the Franklin Bluffs area, up in the Shaviovic country, and several other places, some good potential aquifers that could be tapped for a permanent water supply. Similarly, good soils are available on occasional sites higher above the tundra level, where there can be drainage for whatever kind of sanitation situation we do arrange on, whether it's a lagoon setup or some contained, self-contained system. But what I'm trying to say here, I think, really, is that there are a number of environmental factors that will determine where a place will be one of these days. I think it's entirely incumbent upon industry, upon the state and the federal government, and university, academia as well, to get together now and to think about a feasibility, a site selection study, effort. It doesn't have to be a big study. A team of experts get out and go over the country and decide in some priority sense where such a place ought to be. And then the following step could be industry's internal appraisal of their own operations along with governments to see what would be the design criteria or the operational criteria of such a community. Where would you place it in juxtaposition with a road and pipeline net that will crisscross this country from the Canning to the Colville? How will it best integrate with the job to be done and people living there? Now, there's one other thing I think that should be said, and that's with regard, I think, to the hire of natives in the Arctic and communities. Now, at the present time, there's a couple of, I think, very enlightened industry firms that are hiring native people in Barrow or Kaktovik, and for about 4 weeks they'll work on a site, and then go back for a couple of weeks or longer in such a way that the fellows can go hunting. Eskimo is a meat eater. He needs to get more meat than he can buy at $1.70 a pound, so his cash doesn't really buy his meat. He's got to do his hunting for it, for his family. And this, I think, will take many decades before that, or at least before the economy changes in the, to that extent. At least that's my view. But I'm no economist, but I think we're going to have to get a structure with the native people and their hire that allows some of their ways of life to continue at the same time that they pursue some cash economy. Now, I think it should be recognized that much more than the Tunic, the Eskimo is a very, very much of a family man, and he gets into many, many of mental trauma problems and everything else when their families are disassociated. And one of the things that I think must be recognized by industry is that if they're going to have an effective, happy workforce among the native people in the Arctic, that they keep the family together and also work in a pattern of employment that that makes sense to their culture and their way of life. So I think this is another criteria aspect of a community. Now, in the Inuvik experience, one of the things they left out was the social structure of the town. And they built a very nice town in Inuvik, and then the Eskimo people from Iqaluit and up further in the Reindeer Station and other places, they moved in, and they have a shack town, as you saw in the photograph, where there's no electricity and there's no water supply and so forth. So I think whatever the concepts of a design for such a community, whether they be in more of a conventional basis or whether we talk whole environmental domed communities or partially environmental string situations, whatever these concepts that we're able to develop and work out, they must have a social structure as well as a physical and environmental structure to them. Thank you.
Well, now I invite any questions. We may have a fully exhausted you as well as the subject, but any questions, we'll try to answer.
I think so. I just want to find.
Yes.
My name is Andrew Feinfeld. This is a question for Professor Siemens. you were discussing the problem of democratizing the company panel, and so I understand that this wouldn't be directly within your province, but because you're not a lawyer, because you're Canadian, I wonder if you know of studies, or if you yourself have done any studies or speculation in the area of the effect of the recent Supreme Court decision, March against Alabama, which treated some aspects of company town life as state action requiring application of parts of the Constitution normally applicable in governments to company towns. Or if not, if you could speculate yourself on what might happen if there were a sudden requirement that company towns maintain themselves like ordinary governments.
Well, I'm afraid I have very little to comment on this. I mentioned that personally, I'm fairly new in this area. I'm aware of some studies going on in terms of the whole problem of political process in towns which at one time were strictly company controlled, but in which the residents have of late been demanding involvement and participation, but I don't think I can comment or speculate any further on your question.
Yes.
My name is Barry Weisenberg. Given the rapid rate of development that will likely occur with mineral exploration, such as oil, seems the most likely way to achieve a balance between the development and the delicate, fragile nature of the Arctic ecology is for some kind of comprehensive land use plan, in fact, rather than the mere establishment by river, which is mostly what it will accompany industrial development. And that given the revenues likely to occur from the leases, that there's a great potential for a comprehensive land use development policy, which will in fact establish both the necessities of ecological and environmental concerns with development programs on a rationally ordained basis rather than the helter-skelter development. And I'm wondering if there's any indication that such a comprehensive land use plan might occur in regard to Alaska.
You ought to toss that to Tom Kelly.
Well, I'd comment on that briefly, if you...
Go ahead, Dave.
I just would only say this, that there have been some attempts to do it. But as long as this the oil industry is structured the way it is, without a structure across the board where they can agree on approaches together, without the federal and the state government getting together, I think you'd have to say it has not happened and it's been a failure to date, period.
Well, I think one thing that ought to be said here is that oil development per se is not going to lead to large community development in the Arctic. This is one of the mistakes that people make. What I was saying is that I think that there's a great misunderstanding regarding the size of the communities that develop in relation to the oil industry. Unless you put in a railhead on the North Slope, I think you're going to continue to have what you have now, which is a series of base camps. Those will become permanent base camps, just as Atlantic Richfields at Prudhoe Bay is becoming a permanent camp. But it's going to hold a few hundred people, and those people are going to be rotated in and out so that you aren't looking at normal community development in those areas, and you aren't looking at large numbers of people in there. And this is one of the things I was trying to point out before. You get into large groups of people when you move south on the South Fork of the Brooks, on the south side of the Brooks Range, and particularly if you get into mineral development, because mineral development takes a large number of people, and they're in an area where it's logical and natural to build a permanent community.
Could I say a word before calling you? I think the gentleman back here is thinking in terms of more of a state and federal interest in such developments of community action. And I'm convinced myself that there must be this interest if we're going to exercise a police power or a state power, whatever you want to call it, in a proper development. And this doesn't mean you're going to do it this way, but there must be some planned attack on communities. We just can't have these communities just springing up and being helter-skelter, no plan to them. This must be avoided. I don't know the mechanism and can't cite it to you off the cuff that would take place, but I'm convinced that in the interest of the Alaskan development, that there must be a broad approach to this problem. Yes.
Richard Hill, a resident of the much maligned village of Dewey, and as a member of the Dewey Village Council, I feel called upon to invite anybody who is here to come and visit in the big city and see if what you say or the impression is true. I don't think it is. I'm a little prejudiced after 6.5 years residence. We have some 3,000 people there. Over half of them indigenous people who must be there because they don't like it too badly. Every home is fully serviced with things like electricity, telephones. Some of the homes are on the villador with running water and sewage. Every other home has water delivery and sewage pickup. But I don't particularly defend it, but it is a viable, happy northern community.
I think we could say one thing. You've made a far bigger effort than we have in our Arctic.
I think it is a positive development, and much can be learned from it, although we certainly have many problems.
I am sure that the Canadian groups that took a hand in that development are to be complimented. We don't reach utopia overnight. We've got to go by steps. Anyone else? Yes?
I think I understand what Mr. Fitzgerald is talking about, this so-called camp of 200 people near the drill site. But I wonder, is there a conflict here when Mr. Hitchcock says he's going out to see where the ideal site for a village or a city? Are you people talking about the same kind of thing?
Or? No, I'm not talking about that at all. I think that the application of a number of forces will affect a community somewhere up there. In fact, I think the communities are happening now, the roots of them. Now, I don't want to enter into argument with Joe. After all, he used to be my boss, and I never argued with him then, and I certainly wouldn't start now, but I do think that that one will come, and I only was looking around while I was working on other things to see where or not where one might go that would make some environmental sense.
No, we don't have any quarrel here. What I was saying initially was that I believe that if you build a railhead into the north, then you will have a substantial community on the north slope. And I think it's quite obvious in the very nature of surface transportation. You build a railhead and then you fan out from there. Just as with air, you serve to a series of individual airports, which you're doing now in the north. The other point is that the random growth of communities, and I don't think Dave and I have any disagreement here at all, we expect it'll probably happen, but I don't think any of us have too much idea just where, when, or to what extent, and what will be the economic forces that bring it about. They certainly aren't in the oil industry itself, and that was the point that I was trying to emphasize, that the oil industry's normal development, pattern development in the north, is going to be on the basis of base camps rotating personnel in and out. And I think this makes a great deal of sense. I think that the natives of Barrow are going to be happier getting jobs. I think our big impact in the north, as far as the native is concerned, is that once we run a money base under the native, he can go back to Barrow and have decent housing that the government should have given him years ago. But now he can have it on his own.
Yeah.
So assuming the directors, Mr. Hickok refers to, that this is coming, adopting this gentleman's comments about a comprehensive plan of how it should come, I'm working at the present time in the AFN, and I'm working with present current federal programs. One of the things that I see is that the present Alaskan problems, the Arctic, the problems Western Alaska, are attempting to apply formulas of programs designed with consideration of the ghetto or urban scene. They assume a establishment backup to a community that just doesn't exist in the bush. And we have some remarks about the oil from Joe, or somebody there, the oil companies will not work in unison. The state, the federal will not work in unison. Well, I think they will, and that I feel that this is a legislative problem, either federally or state-wise, and probably the state will be more adaptive in terms of setting the priorities and making the framework under the fact that they, when the land freezes, raised and selection will go on again on the land, they can lay the rules on how it's going to be used and where it's going to be used. But I think that maybe it's a federal concern now to mount some sort of a program to establish the priorities that Mr. Hickok was talking about, and that these should be pulled together, and these sites nominated now. Broader considerations are other potential economic development in terms of other minerals, just besides oil. There's other things that can happen in the Arctic. Now, on the question of where the city is, when it's going to happen, if you put a road up there, the helter-skelter pressures are going to come. They always have. In fact, looking at the Western Alaska, say that this may be the ticket to lowering costs of supply, allowing the native to get into Anchorage cheaply by hitchhiking, driving a flivver. It'll accelerate the cultivation that seems to be the inevitable way that things are going. And I feel that we do need some format for Alaska, somebody to do some basic planning.
I can't help but agree with you. Someone over here? Yes.
I think that our biggest problem, we all know, is that we have no economy as a military. Byproducts, they say that you can irrigate enough oil for byproducts.